I'd just like to welcome you to Planet Waves FM and thank you for taking the time to come onto the program this busy time of year.
Well, thank you for having me on the program.
And now you're a professor of English, is that true?
That's right. I'm a professor of English at the University of Ottawa, and I mainly teach 19th century literature and Canadian literature.
Excellent. Well, the previous guest on the program was Andrew McLuhan, the grandson and son of two English scholars. Marshall was an English professor. Most people don't know that. Taught Shakespeare.
That's true.
And he taught the canon pretty much. And then his son Eric was trained as an English professor, but then basically spent his life working with his dad and then continuing that. Right. Anyway, so it's a Canada Week here at Planet Waves, and I discovered you. Someone on my research team discovered you in the course of some weird events that took place with me over the summer involving basically a hoax Me Too call out. It seemed like a nice, simple way to get me fired from a few places, call me names and get me fired. And what I found out in speaking with you and listening to your work was that I'm not alone in this happening, that this happens quite a bit, actually.
Yeah, unfortunately, I've heard from many, many, many men that have had this happen to them. That have been accused of all sorts of things, ranging from the very trivial to the quite serious, often with no evidence provided whatsoever, but with devastating consequences for these men's reputations and lives. And it's really disturbing that so many businesses and universities and publishing companies and newspapers are willing to bow to threats or baseless allegations. Well, we don't know for sure that they're always baseless, but allegations without any evidence, and to punish men because women say that they should be punished. So, yeah, it's a big problem that has, I think, probably existed for some time, because companies have been concerned about sexual harassment and sexual misconduct of all kinds, you know, for decades, at least since the Anita Hill hearings. But since the Me Too era, it seems that everything has just ramped up.
Well, it's ramped up by the internet, by social media. There wasn't Twitter.
Yeah,
there wasn't Twitter before.
That's true. Right. Mm-hmm.
And so this can turn a local thing into a worldwide thing, it can turn nothing into something.
Mm-hmm.
And plus, almost everyone is operating anonymously.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, I know a case, for instance, of a young man who had a number of women got together and talked about their relationships with him and discovered that they felt aggrieved. They felt that they had been badly treated by him. So they, in a very short time, decided to orchestrate a campaign against him. None of the allegations against him were criminal, and they didn't make any attempt. You know, they weren't interested in pursuing criminal sanctions against him, but they wrote to his various employers. He worked as a part-time teacher at the University of Pennsylvania. He taught creative writing there. They set up a website called Joseph Massey, the Poet, is an Abuser. They claimed that they had all sorts of evidence, but they never produced any evidence. They wrote to various publishing companies that had published his work. And in a very short time, he heard from the head of the department at the University of Pennsylvania that he would no longer be employed there, but, you know, citing safety concerns. And various of his publishers informed him that they wouldn't be publishing his work. His name was taken off the American Association of Poets. You know, all sorts of sanctions almost immediately following letters that these two women had written alleging that he was an abuser. And so, it's quite remarkable the number of people who are willing to sacrifice men's careers in order to appease an angry feminist mob.
I'm trying to make the connection between a woman who may feel like she didn't have a satisfying relationship experience, or may feel that a man wasn't whatever was or wasn't whatever,
yeah,
and his employment mm-hmm. at a university. I can understand if a person is abusive at work or is found to be abusing their professional position in some way. That at least makes a little more sense, assuming that there is some kind of process followed. But I don't get the thing where, like, you know, you annoyed me one day 15 years ago, and therefore now you shouldn't be an employee of the XYZ widget company.
Yeah. Well, I mean, part of it is that feminist theory or a feminist conception of the world doesn't really make a clear distinction between one woman being feeling that, you know, she was badly treated by a man in whatever way, and a kind of abusiveness that constitutes a danger to all women. So there's a direct line in the feminist worldview between any man who has treated any woman badly and that man's status as a danger to women. So, for instance, if you have a university position, then you may well come into contact with young women, and therefore you need to be prevented from exercising your power, as they always imagine it, over women. And I think that extends to, basically any man in the public sphere. In the feminist worldview, if a man can ever be said to have behaved badly in his relationships with women in the past, then, you know, he must not be able to be in any position where he could behave badly again in the future.
I guess that would mean stuffed into a cave. And, I mean, that would be stuffed into a cave with a glass mm-hmm. of water and a bowl of popcorn and left to die.
Well, yeah, basically. I mean, I think, you know, they, of course, it wouldn't be framed in those terms, but I think that is essentially it. The idea is that, and this is fueled by decades and decades. Of course, this is all my opinion, I should say that. I am an English professor. I'm not an expert in gender, but this has been fueled by decades and decades of feminist grievance mongering about the whole history of the human race, which is seen in the feminist lens as a history of men abusing women. So now, under the Me Too dispensation, you know, a lot of men and some women are coming forward and saying, hold on a minute. I mean, it's fine to have a conversation about sexual relations. And, you know, let's have that conversation. If some people feel that they've been sexually harassed or they've been coerced, that we need to have discussions about how to prevent that from continuing into the future. But to start accusing people and making the assertion that an accusation is itself a conviction of guilt, you know, that's going way too far. But in response to that, what the feminists will often say is, you know, it's too bad if in this process a few innocent men have their lives ruined. That's too bad. Although some feminists won't even go that far. They'll say, well, I'm fine with that. But, you know, if that's necessary to right this mass injustice that's been going on, then, you know, that it's unfortunate, but it's certainly justifiable, because in the feminist worldview, the injustice that's been taking place for women is, you know, on such a mass scale that, you know, one in three women has been sexually harassed in her lifetime, or maybe even more than that if we're talking about unwanted comments or compliments or come-ons or whatever. The idea is that this is just a huge systemic problem that absolutely needs really drastic measures. And one of those drastic measures is believing a woman every time she says that she's been, in quotation marks, abused in some way. And if that means that those men are in some way exiled, if they have to lose their jobs, if they have to be disgraced for life, if they have to be, you know, tainted even without any evidence or any fair trial or anything like that, well, that's perfectly acceptable if you believe that the injustice is this large.
Oh, man. I mean,
I think.
Yeah, I mean,
yeah, it's pretty scary.
I know. I know. And the thing is that it can be so easily weaponized against people who have not done anything just because it's a convenient kind of weapon of opportunity, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a way to get rid of somebody who is a problem in your workplace. If you simply don't like that person, why not make an allegation
against
them?
Professional jealousy. I mean, there's many, many fields where I would say, being polite here, that the less creative people in that field are jealous of the more creative or more successful people in that field who they feel are stealing the spotlight in some way. There's all kinds of competition in academia, in the scientific world, in the entertainment world. There's I mean, we live in a warfare-based, competitive, capitalistic religion society, basically, where it's a zero-sum game played. And so this just seems like it's almost like leaving guns around places where people are prone to have arguments.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, it is. It's like having that's the metaphor that a friend of mine used too. It's like having a loaded gun in, but it's only in, you know, the only person who can use that loaded gun is the woman in these cases, because it doesn't work in reverse. You know, a man is not going to be able to ruin a woman's reputation and career with some allegation, you know, that she repeatedly asked him out for dates. So the women have the loaded guns, and every man, if he's not been living under a rock for the last year or so, every man knows that every woman in the workplace or in anywhere in the public sphere has that loaded gun, and she can fire it off at any time she wants to. And you don't even have to imagine that, you know, that career jealousy is necessarily a motive. I mean, I think just wanting attention, you know, just wanting the oodles of sympathy that pour out for any woman, you know, who is for any woman who is supposedly courageous enough to come forward. I mean, what courage it takes to make an allegation that then is, you know, immediately prompts a massive outpouring of admiration and empathy and concern. You know, I don't know what courage that takes, but certainly if you are somebody who craves that kind of attention and you know, the kind of career advantages that come to someone who then can step forward and claim to be a spokesperson for all abused women, that's very attractive to a lot of people who are looking for a kind of public niche or just looking for their 15 minutes of fame. So, yeah, I think there are all sorts of incentives for women to make allegations, and they're not even necessarily false, but often, you know, they're slightly exaggerated in order to make them fit the narrative of, you know, abusive male power and vulnerable female, you know, innocence.
Well, let's take that construction for a second, because that's a worldview all by itself.
Mm-hmm.
Right, that posturing of women are innocent and weaker and victims, and men are powerful and abusive and power mongers, and these are inherent, supposedly, in this worldview, in this construction. It's purely you don't need to be a theorist of any kind to see this is an intellectual construction. This is a concept of the world, and there's many such concepts. How did that come to be from the idea of feminism, which was based on the idea of women being equal and having equal responsibility and equal rights? That's what I thought feminism was, that there were going to be rights and responsibilities that both men and women would have, and we would agree to fulfill those responsibilities and have those rights. And that's what, when I was originally sold feminism, the reason I bought it was because I liked the way that sounded.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of men liked the way that sounded. And you know, there was an, I think my answer to that would be that feminism was never really about that. And wittier people than I have said, you know, have actually defined the history of feminism to say that, you know, the first wave of feminism was about giving women the rights that men had without the attendant responsibilities that men had, so that women had the same rights but never had the same responsibilities. For instance, the responsibility to defend your country in times of war. Mm-hmm. And then later waves of feminism were about taking rights away from men and, you know, making sure that women had rights that men didn't have at all, and giving women all sorts of privileges that, that men didn't have. So you could say that there was a strand of the feminist movement that was about equal rights and responsibilities, but there was always a very strong strand of it that was about women as victims. If you go back and read, you know, feminist literature from the 1970s, you know, there's a whole radical wave with Andrea Dworkin at the forefront, and Robin Morgan and Susan Brown Miller and Catherine MacKinnon and all sorts. And these are the ones that were adopted most enthusiastically as primary reading in women's studies courses. So starting in the late 1970s, you had that very powerful strand that wasn't about equality really at all, but was about patriarchy theory, that cast all sexuality as male dominance of women, you know, and we actually have texts where the feminists outright argue that you know, if you look at rape and you look at ordinary heterosexual intercourse, you really can't see much difference between the two in terms of the way that the man exercises his power over the woman, the way that the woman is objectified, the way that the woman is demeaned and humiliated and, you know, feels like a victim and all these kinds of things. And that became, you know, that became the dominant strand. It took over from the equal rights strand, which was never as sexy and as interesting. It's, you know, always been, I think, incredibly seductive for women to see themselves as victims of male tyranny. It gives you a euphoric rush and, you know, the ability to hector and lecture and to stand up in crowded halls and have a hush fall as you tell your victim story and everyone has to listen and nobody can contradict you or ask any questions, because if they do that, that means they're a victim blamer and that means they're a misogynist. That is very, it's a very powerful feeling, and it's very difficult to resist. So that's what took over starting in the 1980s. That became the dominant strand of women's studies courses, which in a very short time became, you know, were offered at universities all across North America. And so we've had decades now of women and men being educated in that patriarchal theory model and going out and becoming activists, working in the legal field, becoming journalists, you know, going into media in general, going into teaching in the humanities, you know, going into the public schools, and so that has essentially taken over, and it's now sort of generally accepted that, I think it's generally accepted that many women, many, many women have had these terrible, dehumanizing, life-destroying experiences, and that the role of men in this whole conversation is simply to shut up and listen. And if a woman says she was abused, you better not question it, because that means you're a terrible misogynist.
Yeah. It was very interesting just personally to see this go by, really knowing the truth about my relationships with women. Mm-hmm. Really, because I know the story of my life, and I know the people in my life, and moreover, the women in my life know me. And to watch this happen was the true definition of surreal. It was completely mm-hmm. another dimension beyond, to watch this completely false paradigm of myself created. And there were several interesting features. One of which was, early in the Me Too movement, I understood that there was going to be a problem with men being allowed to express what had happened to them. And a lot of men have been abused in and out of the workplace. Mm-hmm. There have been terrible things happening. If a heterosexual man is fucked up the ass against their will, that's really a bad thing. For example, mm-hmm. if anyone is, but so mm-hmm. just to give an example, but I told an abuse story in the New York Daily News. As far as I know, I was the first man to come out publicly in the national media and basically just say, this actually happened to me. And I did not name the person who was involved. I made no attempt to in any way harm them or shame them, and they've been deceased for about 8 years, and I left, the person died on good terms with me. I had no, I believe in working out my relationships. But anyway, that was held against me in this discussion. That the fact that I had experienced something negative was just simply taken as evidence that I was this person they were saying that I was. The second one was that men in this position are not allowed to speak in their own defense at all. They're accused of all kinds of other things when they speak in their own defense. How can anyone in Western society, where we supposedly honor some concept of like, you know, logic, be accused of being guilty merely for speaking on their own behalf?
Well, I just think that it is a testimony to the extent to which a deep irrationality, which is probably a factor in, you know, all human societies at all times, and part of being a civilized society is keeping that irrationality under control. But what we're now seeing is the bursting out of that irrationality in the Me Too movement. So that, yes, even for a man to speak in his own defense, or to try, as you said, to speak about his own experiences of sexual abuse, you know, both of those are essentially forbidden in the Me Too movement, although technically I suppose men are allowed to talk about their experiences of victimization. But really, Me Too as a phenomenon is not very interested in men as victims. And, you know, there's probably a very complex socio-psychological explanation for why, you know, in general, societies are not very interested in men who have been victimized, because they're seen as weak. You know, they're seen as not useful to the society. Men are supposed to be the protectors. You know, we have this deep, I guess, in our genes, in our DNA as a culture. Men are supposed to be strong, and so men who are victims are either not believed or are just not of interest to our culture, really, very much at all. You know, no matter how much we talk about how progressive we are and how far we've come from our more primitive ancestry, I think, you know, we still have a big problem with male victims, unfortunately. And you know, I think what we're undergoing is, as a secular society, largely speaking, we're finding that it isn't possible to operate without some versions of the sacred. And one of the versions of the sacred that has acquired incredible power in our society is the idea of the sacred feminine. And that's why women can actually come forward and say that we should believe women. I mean, why? Why would you think that? It's like saying, why would you believe anyone without evidence, aside from, you know, your own intimate family members and friends whom you might believe, or even then, maybe not entirely. But, you know, this idea that there is something sacred about women's words, and also, of course, sacred about women's bodies, that has a deep, you know, place in human cultures, too, because women's bodies are the source of life. And now we have this idea that even to touch a woman in a way that she hasn't consented to, you know, to hug a woman. I had a case in my church a number of years ago, where a woman complained about a man at the beginning of the church service. Most churches have this thing where you go around, you know, greeting everyone. Yep. And some people hug and, you know, others shake hands or whatever. Well, there was one man in the congregation who used to hug everyone, and he was a very sweet man, and I don't see how anyone could possibly think that there was anything sexual about the hugging. I mean, it takes place in a second, and there are a whole bunch of other people around. You know, but this woman complained, and she wanted this man expelled from the church community because of the way he hugged her.
Right.
Even though her husband was there with her and everything else. But, I mean, where does that come from? And, you know, and I've heard things like, I mean, this is now actually part of most workplace sexual harassment policies. An act of harassment can be defined as a hug or a pat on the shoulder, or any kind of unwanted touch, even on your clothed body. I mean, what kind of idea of the, you know, the precious sacredness of the female form has to underpin such a notion of sexual misconduct. It's really, you know, it's quite remarkable. But I think only that, a kind of religious belief in the sacredness of the female, in every aspect of the female, the body and her words, only that can really explain the level of deference and obeisance that we are supposed to give to women's complaints of, you know, of victimization.
That's really interesting. One thing I noticed vis-a-vis your story about the man in church is that, and we've seen this in practically every case, is that there's never really a concept of what it might mean to correct or heal such behavior were it either inappropriate or not construed as appropriate or, in fact, actually harmful. There's never a discussion about what can we do to help? What can we do to educate this person or educate the community to improve matters? It's always going straight into the harshest form of punishment, which in primate society is to be excommunicated.
Mm-hmm. Right, and that's essentially what tends to happen, or what the particular feminist community tends to call for, is a depersoning of whoever it is that's accused. Essentially, yes, and that person is to be exiled from the community. It is extraordinary, and that, you know, so many of the cases are, you know, at least from my perspective, relatively trivial. If somebody hugs you at work and you don't like to be hugged, what's the big deal about telling the person that you'd prefer not to be hugged? Like, there's so many. I mean, it's so simple. In so many cases, you just say, "I'm sorry." You know, you can even say it in a nice way that protects the person's feelings. If you're, you know, a very feminine woman who doesn't, you know, who has trouble being assertive, which is one of the things that feminists often say, you know, "I'm sorry, I feel uncomfortable when you make those kinds of jokes." I'm sorry, you're a very nice person, but I'm never going to want to date you or whatever because I'm interested in somebody else or whatever it happens to be. So many, I mean, obviously, if the person is actually, you know, sexually abusing, then that's different. But so many of these cases are verbal, what constitutes verbal harassment, you know, repeated requests to go out on a date, that kind of thing. And instead of just dealing with it in the way that an adult, one would presume, would be able to do, we have to go direct to, you know, discipline and punish instead. And it is really quite extraordinary, as if women are incapable of dealing in an adult manner with these kinds of workplace situations. Quite extraordinary.
This is why I think that the Me Too movement is the very antithesis of feminism.
If we define it as equal rights and responsibilities, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, yes. It does seem that what we're being told is that women are incapable of operating as adults in sexual relationships and in most public sphere interactions. That's what we're being told over and over again. And it makes me think, I mean, in the old days, in the Victorian times, there were all sorts of rules around all interactions between young women or any women and men outside their family. And of course, you know, in the Middle East, there are still these kinds of rules. And you couldn't speak to if you were a young man who was interested in a young woman who wasn't a member of your family, you could not speak to her until you had been introduced by, you know, a mutual friend. And then there were all sorts of rules around, you know, what kinds of conversations you could have, what sorts of subjects could be raised, whether you could even call her by her first name for, you know, a long time in the relationship. You would have to call her Miss Bennett or whatever. And only when you had achieved a certain level of intimacy could you actually use her first name, maybe even after you'd proposed marriage. And, you know, so there were all sorts of rules hedged around all relationships between men and women. And, you know, we now laugh at those and say, oh, thank goodness, you know, we don't live like that anymore. But Me Too, in a way, you could read it, I think, as an example of the way in which we, you know, the Victorians were not so wrong, perhaps. Perhaps many women prefer that degree of security and protection over freedom and over having to take responsibility for you know, for their own lives, for articulating their own desires, you know, for taking responsibility for their own actions, because that's another facet of Me Too, which I find deeply disturbing. And this has been going on even before the Me Too movement. The idea that sexual misconduct can actually be defined retroactively, so that a woman can go out with a guy, have a few drinks, go home with him, be sexual with him in some way, and then the next day decide that she didn't consent to it. I mean, that's, to me, just utterly bizarre, and this notion that if you've had even a couple of drinks, that somehow makes you incapable of consenting. So then everything you do thereafter, you can then retroactively redefine it as sexual aggression on the man's part, even if he's been drinking alcohol too, because of course, you know, he never gets these kinds of exemptions from personal responsibility, even if he's just as shit-faced as the woman is. So it is certainly a kind of infantilization, but you know, we do not give to infants and children in our society the kind of power that we're willingly giving over to women. We do not give children of, you know, 7 years old the capacity to ruin men's careers and lives and have them fired from their jobs. So at the same time, we're saying women aren't responsible for what they do, or even for communicating clearly with men what they want and what they don't like. They're not responsible for that, but we do give them the responsibility to decide whether a man can keep his job or not. So it's bizarre.
It really is strange.
And I don't know, you know, is it going to end? I mean, I don't see it winding down. I have friends who say, you know, they keep bringing forward these various cases and saying, this one is going to really show just how crazy Me Too has become. But it never seems that there is any kind of, loss of public confidence in the importance of listening to women. Or, you know, in fact, I would say that it keeps on ramping up, and it is now actually, you know, seriously undermining our whole legal system, that feminists are making, you know, various kinds of gains in the legal system about what kinds of defenses men are allowed to make to charges of sexual assault, what kind of, evidence they're allowed to bring in order to prove that the woman consented. You know, there's a move to make it that defense counsel will actually have to show the judge what kind of evidence they have in forms of, you know, text messages and emails, so that the woman can't, the accuser will not be surprised by the fact that the man kept all the emails from years ago that proved that, you know, the sex was consensual. I mean, there really is a move. I don't see how you can understand it in any other way, to make it that a woman can have a man not only ruined in his personal life, but actually found guilty and sent to prison on a charge of sexual assault, just based solely on her word.
And at the same time, limiting the right to defense.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely.
I mean, that's a whole order of magnitude more disturbing. For example, any move to block exculpatory emails, for example, to me it seems very much agenda driven. I mean, if I were an evil person and I were like working in the COINTELPRO lab, I don't know if you know about this federal program from the 1960s and 70s that was basically designed to infiltrate all the political movements and destroy them.
Mm-hmm.
But if I were an evil person and working in the COINTELPRO lab, and I wanted to destroy relationships between men and women,
mm-hmm.
and I wanted to make feminism seem so ridiculous that nobody could ever take it seriously, I can't think of something better that I would come up with than the tactics of the Me Too movement. This set of tactics.
Yeah.
And I think for anyone who's concerned about whether they really are aspiring to personhood, whether they really want to address this problem of what on some level is an imbalance in society, I admit that. But I'm 54, and I don't
admit it.
Oh no, I know. I'm curious to hear your. You have a very. Let me just offer one little bit, and I think you'll be able to jump on that right away and pick up on it. I have seen things get better in my lifetime. I grew up with a divorced single mom in the 1970s who was always expected to be coming to dinner with a man. It wasn't couldn't be a family of three. We were shunned for being a family of three. For example, we were, I've read all of her. I typed her poetry from that era. She used to write poems about how badly she was treated as a woman in the 1970s, and it doesn't even seem nearly even meekly as bad as what you see going on in Mad Men. For example, the Mad Men series, where they mm-hmm. portray the other side of the 1960s, right? We think of the 1960s mm-hmm. as being the Haight-Ashbury and peace and love and tambourines and all this stuff. And meanwhile, going on in corporate America, there's all of this, pretty overt sexism going on, right? And it's mm-hmm. sexual sexism. It's not merely structural. You can only be a secretary. And I get that's a fictional representation, but pretty much everyone agrees that's an accurate representation of history. And in my short lifetime, I have seen things get better. The men are much more polite. The behavior of men from the 50s and 60s would never be tolerated today in most places, at least that I go. All the guys I know are sensitive to women. They like women. They're respectful of women. They're supportive of women. I don't know mm-hmm. really any... I hate to say this, maybe I love to say it, I don't know any sexist men.
Well, I don't either. I mean, that's the thing that struck me when men started writing to me years ago when I gave my first talk. I was really struck by the lack of anger on the part of men who have been told, many of these men are quite young, so they've been told from day one that women are special, that they have to go out of their way to make sure that, women are both protected and allowed to advance, that women's freedom, women's self-determination, women's aspirations to careers, that all those things have to be respected, and they're perfectly happy. I've never met a man who said, well, I think it's lousy, women, should stay in the home. They're perfectly happy to work alongside women as long as the women are, able to make a good contribution. They're happy to respect women's, if a woman's no, in terms of emotional and sexual relationship, all that sort of stuff. And most of them, it's so sad because their greatest desire is to have equal relationships with women, both as friends and to have, a special relationship with a woman they want to marry and have children with. That remains, I think, a very strong, compelling desire for an awful lot of men. And they're just bewildered by the level of, hatred and accusation and blaming that comes their way constantly in their classes, in the workplace, in the kinds of workshops they have to attend, the sensitivity training, the gender sensitivity, the, consent classes and all, those kinds of things that they have to, it's never been an issue for them. So I don't know who these men are. I mean, I'm willing to, accept that there are some bad men around, but the idea that all men are somehow, responsible or that there's just pervasive rape culture, that men in general demean women and objectify them and so on. I mean, they objectify them in the sense that they see them as beautiful and, they fantasize about their bodies, but I don't think you're ever going to read that out of men.
But women do that too. Women do that too.
Oh, yeah. Women do that too, absolutely.
Of course
somehow
they do.
When women do it, it's okay. That's what you were told. That's what the feminist movement essentially has told us, that when women do it, it's not demeaning somehow, because women don't have power. Women, women aren't able to. Anyway, that's just that one of so many double standards. So but to get back to your point about, whether things have improved, I mean, I'm in a difficult position. I don't accept what Mad Men tells us because, Mad Men is a fictional representation. I don't even accept what women necessarily tell me from that period because women have been encouraged by our entire culture, by the last 50 years of feminist proselytizing, to remember only the bad things about the past and to really to play those up. That's become part of, every woman's identity is, that she had it bad. So I'm not sure. I don't say I disbelieve, but I take it all with a grain of salt. I mean, I studied in my PhD thesis, I was interested in women writers of 19th century Canada. So I looked at women who were breaking into the fields of journalism and the writing profession in general way back in the 1880s. And a lot of these women had wonderful experiences. One in particular came from Brantford, Ontario, a woman named Sarah Jeanette Duncan. She was a journalist in her early 20s. She worked at the paper called The Globe, which eventually became The Globe and Mail. She worked there, you know, for a couple of years. She went down to Washington, worked for The Washington Post. She had a wonderful time, and she wrote about all sorts of social issues. She was interested in feminism. You know, she wrote about the question of whether women, you know, should have the right to vote or not. And she had some very interesting skeptical things to say about the ability of women to, you know, to be full political actors. And she even said, you know, it's all very well for women to claim moral superiority. It's interesting that, you know, women even did that back then. That was the basis for their claim for the right to vote, that women were morally superior to men. And, you know, she said, that's fine to claim you're morally superior, but you're going to need more than moral superiority in order to really make the hard decisions that need to be made in making political decisions and adjudicating, you know, political questions. You're going to have to know a lot more than most women are interested in knowing. And so she was a skeptic even back then about feminist claims about women in the public sphere. But she, you know, she had a wonderful time. And, you know, it may well be that there was then a dip in, you know, in the 1950s, that there was this, you know, reassertion of patriarchal norms. That's certainly what we're told, and that this led to all sorts of very bad sexist behavior. But I'm not sure. I mean, Barbara Kay, I don't know if you know her, the journalist who works for the National Post. She's written about her experience growing up in the late 1940s, early 1950s, and going to university, and, you know, her experience of relationships with men and being a woman at that time. And you know, she found she was incredibly encouraged. And certainly my experience, I'm a little, you know, I'm slightly later. I was born in 1964, So I started school in the early 1970s. I experienced absolutely nothing but encouragement from all of my mentors. I was always treated respectfully. I was never made to feel that, you know, that there was anything I couldn't do. I had a pretty, you know, relatively conservative, traditional set of parents, but they were very enthusiastic about encouraging me. I know I could have decided I wanted to be an astronaut, you know, and they would have been perfectly pleased with that. My dad was a commercial fisherman, and he wanted me to be a marine biologist. I ended up, of course, going into literature. But so, you know, my experience anyway from the 1970s on is that if anything, women were advantaged. I know that some of the young men who went to the same school as I just recently started communicating with a boy that I went to primary school with, now a man, obviously, and he said that he didn't feel any of the anti-male animus that we now notice in our culture so prominently, but that he definitely got the sense that the focus was on girls, and it was a very rah-rah kind of, you know, rah-rah for girls sort of environment. So we've had that. So whatever errors there were in the past, and I think a lot of those errors came not out of male dislike of women, but out of chivalry and concern for women and the attempt to protect women. And maybe that did have a darker side too, in a sexist edge and a rudeness, a sexualizing of women. But there were all sorts of codes of chivalry and respect in those days too. But whatever those errors were, I think that they were very speedily rectified starting in the 1970s. And so this idea now that in 2018 there is this pervasive discrimination and a hatred of women and a demeaning of women is just nonsense. It simply does not exist. And I worry about, you know, exactly like you said, if there were a plot to destroy the pair bond between men and women, to destroy society by turning men and women against one another, that it couldn't have worked out any better than what we've seen over the last 10 years. It absolutely could not have. And the wonder to me is that more men haven't turned against women, because certainly it seems that a large number, at least a significant minority, if not even a majority of women, have turned against men to some extent. And it's just a wonder to me that more men haven't turned against women, because most men are still really, they're willing to reconcile. All they want is for women to call a halt to the blaming and the demeaning language and the, you know, caustic denunciations of toxic masculinity. All they want is for that to stop. And they're perfectly willing to go forward on a basis of friendliness and equality and, you know, mutual understanding and respect. But if this keeps going too much longer, I think we are going to see men saying, forget it. And, you know, some already are. Forget it. Why would I hire a woman? Why would I take that chance? It's way too risky. Why would I even get married when it can all be taken away? All the woman has to do is say that I was controlling. I was abusive. I can not only lose my wife, I have to pay for her. I can lose access to my children. She can say she's concerned that I was abusive towards the children. I can lose my entire everything, and I can be forced to pay her and you know, live in a little tiny miserable apartment, you know, agonizing and lamenting the loss of my family for the next 20 years on the basis of a false charge. And there'll be no sympathy or concern. That most people think I must have done something wrong. So why would I, if I'm a man, why would I get involved with women at all? It's way, way too risky. So I am surprised that most men still want to keep on. Most men still, you know, you could say that it's built into deeply in the male psychology, the desire to love women and to protect them. Mm-hmm. That's part of why Me Too has been able to do what it does, because so many men still feel this very deep urge to look after women and to make sure they're safe and to turn against other men if necessary as soon as an accusation is made. The whole problem is that men don't stand up for other men.
Yep. Yeah. Yes. And if we strip this down to just basic biology and the idea that the female body does something that the male body doesn't do, which is gestates and births life.
Yeah,
but there
so women
is
are precious.
There is something worth acknowledging about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think it does not get into rituals and doing, you know, finger symbols and dancing around with candles, but, you know, acknowledging and thanking women for what they go through and being supportive of that. And this goes back all the way to the beginning of the dawn of humanity, right? That we've had this relationship where women's bodies nurse the babies and that leaves men free to go hunting. I mean, it's pretty much that simple. There's a wonderful book called Sex at Dawn. I don't remember the authors offhand, but there's only one book by that title that takes a history of men and women back to hunting gathering times. And it's somewhat speculative because they weren't back there with iPhones recording everything.
Right.
But it brings it into contemporary times and looks at certain elements of male and female sexual behavior and takes a fresh look at it. Anyway, I'm not sure I was going with that. You know, sometimes I think my therapy background is Gestalt therapy, and in Gestalt therapy, we do a lot of taking responsibility for how we feel, and get out of blaming others for how we feel. And I think there's something here about the abdication of responsibility, because the process of personhood is to some people really frightening. That they're going to have to be a person and face the world and enter not the man's world, but the world, and have to live or die and sink or swim by their own abilities and merits. Right?
Yeah, and I've heard arguments, and I'm not expert in this at all, that you know, as a result of biological realities, that women do tend to, you know, have a greater sensitivity to their own vulnerability, because historically women have been more vulnerable, especially when they're bearing children and, you know, all of that. And so that perhaps even in our modern times, when women are more secure and protected, and at the same time have more freedoms than they've ever had in the past, that still that sense of vulnerability is there, and that fear or anxiety about freedom and about autonomy and taking responsibility, that there actually may be psychobiological reasons for that. Now, I don't know anything about that, so you know, I can merely proffer it as something I've heard, and it seems to be quite interesting. Whereas men are kind of in some way programmed, you know, to be risk takers, because they've had to be in order to survive. The men who passed down their genes were the ones that were really courageous and valiant, etc. Now, I don't know about that, but certainly I agree with you that what we are seeing in the Me Too movement and in starting long before was this deep abdication of responsibility, and it's very, very worrisome. Yet with none of the, there's this blaming of men by women. Everything is the man's fault. Never is it, the woman's responsibility. And there's none of the.
Yes.
I was just going to say, whereas in the past, that was very much a part of public discourse. Women were not seen as full agents in that way. Women were seen as dependent on their fathers and then on their husbands, and husbands had responsibility to pay their wives' debts, for instance, as did fathers. So now we've eliminated that as a form of sexism, but at least in those days too, there was a kind of recognition of all that men sacrificed. Yes, men had power in the family and in society as a whole, but men also sacrificed for their families and in society as a whole. And so now there's this blaming of men for their power and any vestiges of it that remain in men's actions and the way they are in the world. There's a blaming of that, but there's no recognition of any of the sacrifices that men make, and no gratitude to men for building societies that have protected women and that now are so technologically sophisticated and advanced that women are freed from the rigors of the past, the terrors of childbearing. Many women, of course, choose now not to have any children at all. And that's largely as a result of the kind of world that men made possible for women. So the thought that somehow all of this that we have now could have been built by men who hated women and yet created all these technologies to free women, that in itself is nonsensical. Why would men have done that if they didn't love women and mm-hmm. if they weren't listening to what women said they wanted? And some people would say, well, men listened too much and didn't realize that what women said they wanted maybe not have been what women actually wanted at all, since women don't seem to be particularly happy now in their new roles as, professional career people, etc. They seem less happy than ever, even though presumably freedom and autonomy were the things that women said they wanted. So, we're in a really very confused place, and we need some frank discussion about the way forward, but I just don't see very much willingness. I see a lot of willingness on men's part to have that discussion, but I don't see very much willingness, at least on women who speak publicly. I think there are a lot of women in just, in their ordinary private lives who love men, who love the men in their lives and think that what's going on is bizarre. But I don't hear a lot of public female voices calling for honest conversation, which is too bad.
Yep. And to balance things out just a little bit, I want to acknowledge the great many women who supported me, stood up for me, helped me, worked nearly around the clock in my support, ran my company while I was distracted fighting this fight, who took care of my dogs, and who in many ways managed my life while I was unavailable because I was fighting for my life. And I want to thank the many thousands of women readers my company supported. I would estimate approximately 95% by women who did not accept the public version of events and who accepted my version of events and who have continued to be my customers and my clients and my staff members. So one thing I noticed having gone through this particular ringer is that there were many, many women who stood up for me. They may not have been able to do so publicly, but some were incredibly articulate doing so publicly, including a woman named Trish from Toronto, who was in the ring like Muhammad Ali and never, in one particularly vicious part of this fight, wrote some of the most beautiful stuff I've ever heard said about me. So There were even some who were willing to come out, and you'll cry when you read these. I did when I read some of them. I had never read something so deeply, not even flattering, but touching. I mean, one woman who's read me for 20 years, this Canadian woman named Trish, who I don't even know, who won't respond to anything we've written. She's in the background, but she came right to the foreground and said, "Look, I don't know what the fuck you people are talking about, because I've held this person up as an example to my son for the last 20 years. And so I when you read someone's work and you track their growth for 20 years, you get a feeling for who they are. I'm not just an author spewing out a book every 3 years. When you're reading someone mm-hmm. every day or every week and you follow them through all the ups and downs of their life, you get a feeling, especially in my presentation. And she took that and went for it. And every woman who's I'm referring to right now, that you know who you are, and I want to just send out my heartfelt thanks to you for not accepting this crap and for relying on your personal experience with me and taking risks to stand up for me and making sure that me and all the women who work for me still have jobs.
No, that's fantastic to hear. And, you know, that those are the it's on the shoulders of those women that the burden of a future that is seen really rests. So there's a wonderful woman, I don't know if you know her, named Karen Strawn, who is a YouTuber. She's been talking about men's and women's issues, especially, you know, men's issues. She's identifies as a men's rights activist, and she's had a wonderful YouTube channel for years and years and years, and she recently gave a talk in London at the International Conference on Men's Issues. The title was that women must consign feminism, the version that, you know, we've been talking about, the insane version, to the dustbin of history. And her argument is that at this point in time, it is almost impossible for men collectively to sort of stand against, to be voices against the insanity of accusation and false allegation, etc. And that women really need to start speaking publicly against the nonsense. And I do hope, and I do think that, you know, there are a lot of women who aren't interested in the blame game and who love the men in their lives and love men in general and want the best for both men and women. And those are the women that I hope we can hear from in the coming years.
Yeah, you know, I think quite a few listen to this program and have come around an egalitarian, woman-friendly place of mm-hmm. ways where we try to represent everyone's viewpoint fairly. You know, we've always hosted a honest discussion about sex, and I know we've gone on for a while. I think a lot of what happened in the last 20, 30 years is that the generation of young people who were raised on abstinence indoctrination have been part of a process of disowning their sexuality and disowning sex in general, because there was so much negativity campaigned. I mean, these were expensive campaigns reaching into 49 of the American states, and whole generations, basically from kids being quote unquote educated, really indoctrinated from born in the mid 70s onward. And I think this has been a very serious part of the problem. Part of what we have to own is sex itself. I think one of the reasons why anything sexual, which is a byword, but anything sexual is attacked right now is because there has been so much disowning of sexuality.
Could well be. I mean, that's beyond my pay grade to discuss. And I certainly never, I didn't, I grew up in the 1970s and never encountered that at all.
You're in Canada. Fortunately, you're in Canada.
Yeah, so I'm in Canada. But I mean, Canada is going through the same anti-male, anti-sex frenzy as the United States is. So I'm not sure. I mean, I think, yeah, probably it has there's a you know, very multifaceted reason for why we are where we are. But it's long past time that we got out of it, because the yes. paradigm that it's pushing of the, you know, perennially innocent, victimized woman and the perennially oppressive, overbearing, sexually predatory male is simply not in, you know, it has nothing to do with reality, and we really need to discard it and start creating better paradigms.
Yes, and while I'm issuing thank yous here at the end of the year, I want to personally thank all the men who stand up for women, who pass their skills on to women, who inherently see women as equally capable, and in some cases as more capable, and who live that way, not because they were told to, but because that's the way that they know to live.
There's a lot of wonderful men out there. And I would also like to thank the men who stand up for other men and, you know, who don't accept the idea that they should put women first and that their primary concern should be women, because that has nothing to do with equality. You know, if we're really going to care about equality, we're going to care about men and women equally, and we're going to have compassion for both men and women. And it seems to me we've been having a lot of compassion for women for decades and decades, and none for men. And so so I would encourage men to, you know, to put themselves first.
Yep, good. And hey, come what may, you know, 2,000 American men are coming home from Syria. I know this is controversial, but at least those guys get to come home to their families. And there's some women out there, but it's vast majority men.
Yes.
who are there.
98% or something like that. Yeah. So we need to acknowledge the incredible risks and sacrifices that men make, and it's so wrong to imagine that men somehow have something called privilege that women don't have. Men have sacrificed and they've hurt and they've borne burdens, and now they're discriminated against in all sorts of ways. I mean, if you look at the prison population, for instance, it's something like 93% male. Are feminists worrying about the prison gap and, you know, trying to even that out? No, feminists are still campaigning to keep women out of prison, but to get more men in there and to keep them in there longer. So I don't think equality has very much to do with the modern feminist movement.
Yeah, this is another agenda.
It's time we started talking about what real equality would look like and started having compassion for men.
Well, I would like to invite that conversation on Planet Waves FM to anyone who may be listening, and to continue this conversation of what real equality would look like. Janice, I want to thank you. You were one of the most refreshing voices and encouraging voices to appear in the middle of what really was the most difficult time in my entire life so far. And I want to thank you with my whole heart for coming onto the program and sharing your ideas with our listeners here.
Well, thank you so much.
Could not see, and I don't believe you need. get your bright blue ball just spinning, spinning free. Dizzy with eternity. Paint it with a skin and sky, brush and sea, clouds and sea. Place your soul looks from space. Closer look reveals the human race. Full of hope, full of grace is the human race. But afraid, we really are home to waste. This is a figure down here we can't forget. Awake, always around, singing ashes, ashes, I'll fall down. Singing ashes, ashes, I'll fall down. Watching the bomber and the ball for the nighttime ball. Begin the heart begins, begin the blood wind calls. By and by again, the morning's on the rise. The darkness never goes, some men die. Walks and rolls the streets, staking time, dividing up meat. Nightmares spook the peace of him. Flick flash played in the ghetto night. Rudy's looking. Cat alley roll them bones. Need that cash to feed that Jones. The politicians throwing stones. Singing ashes, ashes all fall down. Singing chromosomes and pinstripe houses roll the dice. Anyway they fall, guess who gets to pay the price. Money green, the proletarian gray. Selling guns, set up for today. Oh, the kids, they dance and shake their bones. Politicians throwing stones. Singing ashes, ashes, all fall out. To tell us what we think. If the spirit's sleeping, then the flesh is ink. History's page, living even though it's stone. Future's here, we are here, we are on our own. On our own, we are on our own. On our own, on our own. a Memphis door. With a shining ball of blue, we can call our home. So the kids play dance and shake their bones. Politicians throwing stones, singing ashes, ashes off all out.
You'll not see. come on.